Sure Shame Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Shalom, everybody. This is Bill Cloud, and this is our Torah portion commentary on Balak. Balak, taken from Numbers or Bamidbar, chapter 22, verse 2, going all the way through chapter 25, verse 9. Now, in this portion, we're going to see focus placed upon a heathen prophet's ability and yet futile attempts to curse the nation of Israel. Apparently, Bilam, or Balaam as he was known, was renowned in the ancient world, and so he's called upon to curse Israel. But what we see in the Torah portion, he's going to have to go against his nature and against his self-interest in order to bless them rather than curse them. So one of the things that we learn from this Torah portion is the futility in mankind's attempt to undermine God's purposes for Israel, whether that be Balaam of old or whether that be Ahmadinejad today. Man in his attempt to undermine God's purposes will always fail. So this story is also going to hint at future personalities who, like Balaam, they possess a genuine gift. He was a seer. He prophesied. He had conversations with the Creator. However, he lacked virtue, as others who have gifts in our day and time nevertheless lack virtues. And so they are inclined to misappropriate those gifts for personal gain, and how eventually all those kinds of things catch up with them. Now, in the ancient times, these books were, or these chapters, I should say, were known as the Book of Balaam. Balaam possibly taught that the Creator, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, was the one true God. He was from Mesopotamia. He was from the same region that Abraham came from. Because there were scattered worshipers of God. There was Melchizedek, there was Job, there's Jethro, who was a Midianite. And still, though he is at least knowledgeable of the one true God, nevertheless, he's regarded as a sorcerer, a heathen sorcerer. So he had a gift, he had the knowledge of the truth, but he perverted it all. Again, Balaam is not going to just tell us of somebody who lived long ago, but when we study his personality, it's going to give us an idea what to be looking for, what to be aware of in our own day and time. Now, though he ultimately blesses Israel, his intention was to curse. And so he is called Balaam the Wicked. His disciples, if we can use that word, are those with a haughty mind, those with a proud spirit, and an evil eye. And of course, that characteristic or those virtues or lack thereof is associating Balaam with Amalek and Haman, all of these people who were out to destroy Israel. Now, New Testament writers address Balaam and his infamy, and they warn against his disciples. In 2 Peter, he writes in chapter 2, speaking of these quote-unquote disciples of Balaam, they have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. And in the book of Jude, we see in verse 11, woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. So notice there that Balaam shares company with Cain, a murderer, and Korah, a rebel. Even the Messiah mentions Balaam in Revelation chapter 2, verse 14. He says, but I have a few things against you, because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. So what we see there is Balaam is not the one who necessarily curses Israel, but the one who devises the plot to get Israel to bring a curse upon themselves. He's the one who lays the stumbling block. He's the one who knows that if they're weak, how to entice them into sacrificing to idols and committing sexual immorality. Now, still one eloquent thing that Balaam said is still recited in the synagogue service every time. In Numbers 24, verse 5, he said, how lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. So it's interesting that in Balaam, there are so many different facets of this story. He has all of these grand things to say about Israel. He blesses Israel, and yet he's the one who lays the stumbling block before Israel to try to destroy them. So as we proceed with the Torah portion, we're in chapter 22 of the book of Numbers, and beginning in verses 2 and 3, it says that Balak, who was the king of Moab, saw what Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was overcome with dread. Because at this point in time, Israel was settled on Moab's borders, and so they are overcome with dread, which is to say, they loathed Israel. They hated Israel. That's what it really says, that because they had seen these things that Israel did to the Amorites, they hated Israel. They were in dread of them. Interestingly, the Egyptians in the days before the Exodus were also in dread of Israel. That's in Exodus chapter 1, verse 12. And so it would seem that those who dread Israel want Israel dead. In verse 4, it says, "And Moab said unto the elders of Midian." Now, Moab, of course, is situated close to Midian. Moab suggests that Israel is there to overcome not only Moab, but Midian as well. So here at the beginning of the Torah portion, it's interesting to note that Moab aligns itself with Midian, especially strange when you consider that Moses lived in Midian for 40 years, that Moses married the daughter of Jethro, who himself was of Midian. But nonetheless, Moab and Midian align themselves together, and their confederacy against Israel is really based on causeless hatred, as it is with the enemies of Israel today. They hate them because they're Israel. Now, verse 5, it says that Balak sent messengers to Balaam, alerting him of Israel's presence. He told them to tell him, "A people have come out of Egypt, and they cover the face of the earth." Which, by the way, to cover the face of the earth as his people is exactly what the Creator had in mind. He wants the wheat to fill up the field, which is the world. So anyway, Balak says to Balaam, "A people have come out of Egypt, and they cover the face of the earth." Now Balaam, and spelled in Hebrew, Beit Lamed Ein Mem. That name is thought to be a shortened version of Baal Ha'am, which is Lord Baal of the people, Ha'am. He was from Pethor, which is known in ancient manuscripts as Pithru. In other words, he came from Mesopotamia, somewhere along the Euphrates, which is why we see in the Torah portion reference to the river. The Euphrates was the river. So he comes from Mesopotamia, the same area that Abraham come from. In fact, Jewish literature contends that Balaam was a descendant of Laban or Levan, who of course is a relative of Abraham's. According to Jewish tradition, and I underscore that word tradition, supposedly Laban taught Balaam the black arts. Of course, when we think back to Laban, he was kind of a trickster. He was not the most upright of men himself. So whether or not this tradition is accurate, nonetheless, there seems to be some reason to believe that there's an association between Balaam and between Laban. Now in verse 6, Balak tells Balaam through his emissaries, "Come now and curse this people." My understanding is that ancient nations, and I guess it's true today as well, that there have always been people who had a firm belief in curses and blessings. Now, we believe also, as followers of the Messiah, that there are curses and there are blessings. Of course, we believe that blessing is inherent in obedience. Curses is just the result of disobedience. But what we're talking about here, what these ancient nations believed in, is basically rooted in demonology. Of course, Babylonian communities in that area of the world has always had beliefs in demonology. And so when we talk about curses and blesses in the context of Balaam, that's what we're talking about. That's what Balak is talking about. And so Balak cries out to Balaam, you know, "Come curse these people for me because they're too mighty for me." Which once again, if you think back to the Exodus, that's essentially what Pharaoh's assessment of Israel is. In Exodus 1, that Pharaoh said that they are more and mightier than we. They're going to side with our enemies. So Balak has a lot in common, if you will, with Pharaoh. But in both cases, Balak, the king of Moab, and Pharaoh, they both oppose God's purposes for Israel. Now Balak also tells Balaam, "For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and whom you curse is cursed." If you listen to the prior Torah portion, Chukat, you will remember we mentioned that it is believed that Balak, the king of Moab, had been on the receiving end of one of Balaam's curses. Sihon, who was one of the Amorite kings, overcame Moab and some of its territory as a result of hiring Balaam to curse Moab. And so perhaps that's why Balak says, "I know that whoever you bless is blessed, and whoever you curse is cursed." So again, traditionally, Balaam was the one who had cursed Balak. Now verse 7, it says that the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with rewards of divination. In verse 8, it says that Balaam receives them and he invites them to stay the night, but he's going to have to hear from God first. Now, in the text, these emissaries do not mention Israel by name, and we might assume that Balaam isn't aware of exactly who it is that Balak is referring to. Who are these people that are coming up out of Egypt? We don't know for sure, but we might assume that since Israel is not named by name. Besides that, he seems surprised when he first sees them, suggesting that he has limited knowledge of who he's actually going to curse. But nevertheless, he invites these emissaries to stay with him. "I'm going to find out what God says about this, and I'll report to you in the morning." In verse 9, it says, "And God said unto Balaam," just that statement right there is interesting, because Balaam is not an Israelite. So what do we see here? That the Creator speaks to non-Israelites as well. As a matter of fact, this text suggests that Balaam was well accustomed to hearing from God, and apparently accustomed to speaking to God, because he relates Balak's message to the Creator. In verse 12 it says, "And God said, you shall not go with them, you shall not curse the people." Why? Because they are blessed. So in verse 13, Balaam informs his guests that he has not been given leave to go with them. He doesn't say anything about God forbidding him to curse Israel. He just says that "I can't go with you." And so these emissaries departed. They went back to Balak and Moab. Now, to me, this suggests that this whole story is a process that may have taken months to unfold. Don't know for sure because it doesn't tell us. But you consider if they were coming from Moab to Babylonia, and they're traveling by donkey or camel or something like this, and now they've got to go back to Moab. This probably took months to happen. Now, in verse 15, it says that Balak sent more messengers, more than he had before, and he sent those of greater reputation. Now, this time, Balak promises great honor and basically anything that Balaam would ask for. Nevertheless, Balaam tells him, "Regardless of how much you want to give me and how much you offer me, I cannot go beyond what God says." But notice in verse 19, he tells these emissaries to stay here tonight. Though he's already heard from God, the Creator's already told him, "I don't want you to go with these men. You're not to curse these people. They're blessed." Nevertheless, he says to stay here tonight. So my question is, why didn't he just repeat his former answer if his intent was to do what is right? He knew that God had forbid him to fulfill the request. He knew that he couldn't curse what God had blessed, and yet he tells them to stay the night. It would seem to me that he's trying to find a way to get the reward that Balak is offering and the honor and prestige that he's offering as well. And at the same time, he's going to put up a front that says, "I can't go beyond what God says." It says that he wants them to stay that I might know. He already knew what God was going to say. All of this suggests very strongly that already at this point, Balaam is harboring evil thoughts in his heart. Nevertheless, in verse 20, we see that God came to him and he said to him, "Go with them, but speak only what I tell you to speak." Now, Balaam was trying to justify the journey for personal gain. That's obvious, if not here, certainly by the end of the story. But judging by what happens at the end of the story, it seems that he was already harboring these evil intentions. But nonetheless, God consents to the journey with just the warning against cursing the people. Now, here's my point for bringing this out. God knows what's in his heart. It reminds me of a child going to his mom or dad and saying, "Can I go do this?" And then they say, "No, you can't do that." So the temptation comes on even stronger, and so they're trying to devise a way to go about doing something their parents have already told them to do. So finally their parents tell them, "Okay, you can go," knowing that this child is going to find a way to do it anyway. So the parent says you can go, not because they've changed their mind, but because they realize that this child is just going to have to find out for himself. There's a reason I told you not to go. But if you're just bent on going and disobeying and getting into trouble anyway, then I guess there's nothing I can do to stop you. But you're going to learn a very harsh and valuable lesson through this. Again, God knows what's in his heart. So it seems that the Creator agrees only because Balaam is bound to go to destruction against God's warning. I believe that there are many times that God tries to protect us. He puts things in our path, obstacles in our path when we're on the wrong path. He makes it very difficult for us to do what's in our heart to do when it's of a wicked intent. But eventually, if you're just bent on doing it anyway, perhaps, he removes those obstacles. Perhaps he allows you to go ahead and do what you were so inclined to do in the first place. Balaam, unfortunately, is going to pay the consequences of not listening to what God said the first time. And so, likewise, what we need to glean from this is, if we decide that we're going to continue on pestering, if you will, and pursuing something that is wrong, and we know it's wrong, then we, unfortunately, like Balaam, we will find out that we'll have to pay the consequences as well of not obeying his voice. Now in verse 21, Balaam leaves on his journey with the princes of Moab. But it says in verse 22 that God's anger is kindled against him. And so the question is, why? Why would he tell him you could go and then turn right around and want to strike him down? To me, it would seem God is considering what Balaam is likely pondering in his heart as he's riding down the road. He's told him, go, but don't curse. And so I would think that what's going on here is Balaam is trying to figure out how he can curse them, how he can get around this somehow, devising a plot to curse them, to get his hands on the money, to get his hands on the prestige. Yet somehow he still wants to be able to say that he kept God's instructions, which kind of gives us a hint at what he's going to do later. After he blesses, he's going to lay out a diabolical plan that's going to get Israel to do to themselves what he can't do to them. So if this is what he's devising in his heart, in verse 22 it says, "The angel of the Lord was standing in the way of Balaam as a Satan," oddly enough, which is the same word that we would say Satan. Here it does not have the definite article, ha-Satan, meaning the adversary, but the angel of the Lord is standing as Satan, as an adversary. Now, as you all know, the donkey sees the angel, but Balaam does not. Nor apparently do the two servants who are with him. But the donkey turns away because he sees the angel with the sword drawn. And so when the donkey turns away, the text tells us that Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back in the way. Again, teaching us that he is intent on going to destruction. Now, footnote here. Moses got into a lot of trouble for striking the rock when he was supposed to speak to it, as God had said. Balaam is close to death because he's striking this donkey that's trying to turn out of the way to prevent him from being killed. In other words, Balaam is going to get into big trouble too for striking a donkey because he is intent on doing his own will. In verse 24 and 5, it says that the angel stood in the way, forcing the donkey to run into a wall. So for the second time, the donkey, seeing the angel with sword drawn, tries to avoid the angel, runs into a wall, and when he runs into the wall, this crushes Balaam's foot, which of course is going to prompt him to strike the donkey again. Now, that he crushes his foot is interesting to me because the foot is what is intent on running to evil. In Proverbs 1, beginning at verse 10, it says, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent," which is exactly what Balaam is doing. Sinners, these princes of Moab, come to him to entice him, but he consents. The proverb goes on and says this, "If they say, 'Come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol and whole like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in your lot among us. Let us all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood." So this proverb, or these verses in the proverb, says exactly what Balaam is doing. They've enticed him with profit. They've enticed him with honor. "Come, go with us. We're going to shed innocent blood without cause." He says, don't walk that way. Don't follow these people. Their feet run to evil. So it's interesting to me that Balaam is running to evil. And on this second occasion, when the donkey turns aside, it crushes his foot, which just makes him mad. In verses 26 and 7, it says that the angel positions himself so that the donkey, which is carrying Balaam, cannot turn to the left or to the right. So the Creator, through this angel of the Lord, is putting all these obstacles before Balaam. But Balaam, who can't see what the Creator is doing, is intent on running to destruction. But the donkey sees the angel, lies down, and will go no further, which is going to prompt for the third time for Balaam to take his staff and to strike her. Now, here's something to consider. The seer, Balaam, doesn't see, but the beast of burden does. And if the seer can't see, that would seem to refute his claim to know what God's will is. That would refute his authority as God's spokesman. In reality, Balaam was not God's spokesman. He was a sorcerer. He wasn't a prophet, not a prophet of God. Because if he was a true prophet, then he would have, I believe anyway, he would have told that second group of messengers, "I've already told the first group, I can't go with you. I cannot do what you want me to do." Now, it is true that he did have a gift, and it is true that he heard from God, but he is a sorcerer. He has evil intentions. Now, that the angel had positioned itself so that the donkey, again, consequently Balaam, can't turn to the left or the right, consider that that is to tell us that to avoid destruction, we are not to turn to the right or to the left. We're not to deviate from what the Creator has already told us to do. We're not to devise wicked plans and evil intentions and bring them to fruition, thinking that somehow or another we can do what we want to do and still not go beyond what God has said. If the story of Balaam teaches us anything, it teaches us that when God has said something, to deviate from it at all means destruction. Now, verses 28 through 30, it says that the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she spoke to Balaam and said, "What have I done to you that you have struck me three times?" To which Balaam responds, "Because you mocked me," and says, "If I had a sword, I would kill you right now." Now, it's interesting to me that apparently Balaam is accustomed to speaking to donkeys every day and hearing donkeys speak. Because the donkey starts speaking, and without hesitation, he responds right back to the donkey, "If I had a sword, I'd kill you." Which is kind of ironic, because he was going to slay a nation with his words, but he needed a sword to kill a donkey. Now, this conversation that takes place between the donkey and between Balaam, a lot of commentators take these verses as literal, and some consider this to be a dream or a vision. Now, nothing is impossible with the Creator. So, for him to open up the mouth of a donkey and have him speak is no more miraculous, as far as I can detect, than a speaking serpent. There are a lot of other strange and miraculous phenomena that is told to us in the scripture. The mouth of the earth swallowed Korach. The well that followed the Israelites in the wilderness had a mouth. Miracles are not an interruption of God's laws in nature. So what I'm saying is, I think we should take this literal, because God can just as easily open the mouth of a donkey than he can allow a serpent to speak or what have you. Not only that, but it's interesting to note that it says that God opened his mouth as if to say, up until this point in time, it had been closed. Whatever you think of these verses and what the interpretation should be, I choose to look at them literally. But now Maimonides and others feel that this sequence of events here, that is the donkey and Balaam having this conversation, is a vision or it's a dream. Because it notes that Balaam doesn't show any astonishment at the fact that the donkey is beginning to speak. It doesn't mention the servants at this point. At any rate, there are these varying views. But what we do know is this. The angel is in the way and is standing in the way of the donkey. The donkey is lying down, running into the wall, trying, perhaps indirectly, to save Balaam's life. And so we could say that the angel is, in some sense, an angel of mercy, because it attempts to restrain Balaam from committing a sin and from perishing. Now this angel, who stands in our way at times to prevent us from doing something that takes us to destruction, will often appear in a familiar guise. It can be your spouse, it can be your children, it could be a set of circumstances, a flat tire, what have you. It just seems to say to me that the Creator is merciful and loving and will put obstacles in our way when we have these evil intentions in our heart. He will impede that path because he doesn't want us to go to destruction. But again, from the story of Balaam, we learn that if we are so intent to do it, perhaps he will remove those obstacles. The angel was trying to save Balaam from going to destruction and thus caused the donkey to speak. Think of it this way. Maybe if I have a donkey speak to him, perhaps that'll bring him to his senses. So the donkey asked, in all these years that you have ridden me, have I ever done anything like this? Have I ever turned aside, run into a wall, just sat down? Have I ever done anything like that? In other words, God uses every instrument to alert us to the destruction we seem so intent on rushing to. So ironically, God can cause a beast to say what he wants him to say. Let me say that again. The Creator of the universe can cause a beast to say whatever he wants him to. I'm reminded of the fact that Nebuchadnezzar, who, by the way, in Daniel, eventually turns into a beast for 7 years, in Daniel chapter 2 makes this statement. He regards the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as the Most High God. And then, in other words, Babylon, because Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold on that image in Daniel 2, Babylon speaks and says that the Creator, the God of Israel, is the Most High God. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So God can use a beast, in this case a donkey, to say what he wants him to say. The challenge is to get those who are formed in his image to speak and to do what he wants them to say and to do. In verse 31 through 33, it says that then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and that's when he sees the angel with the sword drawn. And so he bows down, he falls on his face, and then he received a very strong rebuke. In verse 32, the angel says, I'm here as an adversary because your way is contrary unto me. Literally, your way is headlong unto me. You're going headlong toward destruction. And so I've been placed here as an adversary. In other words, to keep you from going contrary to me. Again, that tells us Balaam is contriving this evil plan. How do I get the money and prestige without actually cursing this people? Verse 33, the angel tells him, had it not been for the donkey, the one you've been whipping up on, I would have slain you and let her live. So at this, Balaam acknowledges his sin and he offers to return if it displeases you. Like he's got to ask if this displeases you. He knows that he's displeased them? Why didn't he just turn around and go back? But he says, I'll go back if you want me to. If you're going to be angry with me, I'll go back. Now, when he acknowledges his sin, what sin was he referring to? There's nothing that tells us that he had done anything outright. So might it be that his sin is something that he has been concocting in his heart? And the angel knows that. Bilaam knows that. Now, when he says this, I'll return if it displeases you. In response, the angel answers in Numbers 22, verse 35, and says, Then the angel of the Lord said to Bilaam, Go with the men, but only the word that I speak to you, that you shall speak. So Bilaam went with the princes of Balak. And so for the second time, he is reminded to speak only what is spoken to him to speak. He was warned to guard against this evil intention that's in your heart because it came very close to costing you your life. So don't do it again. You better say only what I tell you to say. Now, perhaps Bilaam is convinced that it's hopeless at this point to attain his goal and to obey God at the same time, his goal being to get the riches, to get the prestige. So I would think that any person who had half a brain would realize, okay, I can't get the money, I can't get the honor, and obey God at the same time. And he suggests returning home, but now he is bound to be God's messenger and to bless Israel. At this point, he hasn't got the choice of going back home. He's going to go and he's going to bless Israel. It's also possible, maybe, that Bilaam completely ignores why the angel was in his path. In other words, he ignores his true motive here. He's trying to convince himself that he's going to go and say only what God has given him to say. And he's trying to suppress the fact that he's got an evil intention in his heart. He wants to get the prestige. He wants to gain the wealth. So when Bilaam finally arrives in Moab, it says that Balak greets him with a, what took so long, more or less. To which Bilaam's response is, I'm here, aren't I? That's Bill's translation. And I'm only going to speak what God tells me to say. So after sacrificing some sheep and some oxen, Balak takes Bilaam to Bamot Baal, or the high places of Baal, or Baal. And this is where Balaam first sees the people of Israel. And so we come to chapter 23, and we see in chapter 23 the blessings that Bilaam is going to pronounce and the prophecies that he's going to pronounce. In verses 1 through 3, it says that Bilaam instructs Balak to build 7 altars, and he prepared 7 bulls and 7 rams. Now, as Balak is waiting by the burnt offerings, Bilaam goes to see if the Lord will meet me. And whatever he shows me, I will tell you. And the Bible tells us that God placed a word in Bilaam's mouth, who then returns to Balak, and we see that he is forced to bless Israel. And so he pronounced the parable to Balak and to the princes of Moab. In verse 8 of this parable, Bilaam asks, How can I curse whom God has not cursed? In verse 9, he is observing them from the mountain peak, and he says this, It is a people who will dwell alone. And the Hebrew word there is badad, which means to be separate. They were going to live separate from all others. He says, They shall not be reckoned among the nations. Literally, they do not reckon themselves among the nations. Because Israel is to be a set apart or a holy nation, according to Exodus 19, verse 6. Now, here's something that we can derive from this. Since it is to be a set apart nation, a separate nation, to dwell alone, so to speak, or separate. Since it is going to be separate, it doesn't need to conspire against other nations. And if it's not going to conspire against other nations, then why curse it? Why not leave them alone? Because what we're going to see is to try to curse Israel is fruitless. There's no point in it. Even when Israel was deserving of a curse, the Creator didn't allow others to do it. Jacob gained a blessing through deception. But Isaac said, Jacob is blessed. Jacob rebuked Levi and Simeon, and he cursed their anger, but he did not curse them. That's in Genesis 49, verse 7. Noah did not curse Ham, he cursed Canaan. even though it appears that Ham is the one who did something in that cave. But why didn't he curse Ham? Why did he curse Canaan instead? Because Ham was blessed, according to Genesis 9, verse 1. You can't curse what God has blessed. Now, another translation of verse 9 suggests that Israel is, quote, from its origin like a rock. In other words, Bilaam is saying that they are established just as surely as rocks and hills are established. Now, that's interesting because in Isaiah 51, verse 1, speaking of Israel, it says, "Listen to me, you who follow after righteousness, you who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were hewn, and to the hole of the pit from which you were dug. Look to Abraham your father, and to Sarah who bore you. For I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him." In verse 11, we see that Balak responds very angrily and asks Bilaam, "What are you doing to me? I've asked you to curse, but you're blessing." But Bilaam insists that he must speak only what God tells him to say. So then, that's when Balak takes him to another mountain, and this mountain is Pisgah. He takes him to the top of Pisgah, and this is where Moses will eventually die and be buried. Not yet, but eventually. So kind of interesting that this is where Balak chooses to take Bilaam. He takes him to a place that the text tells us is the field of Zophim, or the field of the lookouts. And so obviously this is a place that was known to Balak to look out over the valley. Now it's going to be from here later on that Moses is going to see the land and be gathered to his fathers. So it's ironic that Moses is going to be buried where Balak and Bilaam sought to bury all of Israel. So once he's atop this mountain, he's got a different perspective and a different observation point, but it doesn't change the outcome. Because in verse 19 through 20, Bilaam says, "God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do? Or has he spoken, and will he not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot reverse it." So he, nor anyone else, can overturn what the Creator has ordained. He can't curse what God has blessed because he doesn't have the authority to do that. And neither can the adversary curse what God has blessed. In my background, being Pentecostal, I met a lot of people over the years who thought that they had to always be in fear of voodoo curses and witches' curses and Wiccan curses and this, that, and the other. But what the Scripture teaches us, I believe, and I believe this very strongly, is that if you're sealed by the Holy Spirit, if you are one of His, if you're walking in obedience, then the adversary can't curse you. A witch can't curse you. A voodoo doctor can't curse you because God has blessed. No one is able to undermine that. No one is able to overturn that. The only way that you're going to get cursed is when you decide, when I decide to walk our own way, do our own thing, then we open ourselves up to these things. In other words, we are the only ones capable of doing to ourselves what the adversary would like to do, and we do that through our disobedience. The only exception to that would be, of course, that the Creator can do those kinds of things. He could curse us, but He doesn't want to curse us. His desire is to bless us. So the bottom line here is that the adversary cannot curse what the Creator has blessed. Now, in verse 21, Balaam says this, "He has not observed iniquity in Jacob, nor has he seen wickedness in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them." Now, in this verse, when it says that he has not observed iniquity, that has some interesting implications. Speaking for himself, Balaam has looked for a reason to curse Israel, but he can't find a reason to curse Israel. He's observed no iniquity. Now, if it's speaking for God that he has observed no iniquity, then he sees Israel as a nation without spot or stain, or at the very least, they have not committed a sin that would warrant the removal of God's blessing. That's interesting, considering they had in the past sinned mightily against God. So we must conclude that even though they had sinned and had angered God, he would still allow no one else to curse them. And he would not permit anyone else to destroy them. And those who would destroy them, he's not going to allow them to observe their faults. And so if that's the case, does this not speak to us as well where the adversary is concerned? Hasatan. Yes, the Creator knows who we are. He knows what we're about. He knows what we've done. And yet, if we'll repent, if we'll come back to him, he is still faithful and just to forgive us of our sins. And we will become a nation without spot or wrinkle. Not because of our righteousness, of course, but because of the righteousness of the Messiah. But the adversary, who is the accuser of the brethren, looks for faults. He looks for things to accuse us of. So is this saying that Balaam couldn't find a reason to curse them? He couldn't observe any iniquity. Those who would destroy Israel can't observe their faults. Does this suggest that the Creator, when we are walking in obedience, that the Creator would not allow the adversary to observe iniquity in us? Because once again, I don't believe that if we are blessed, the adversary has the ability to curse us. Now, there's another possible interpretation that's given by Ibn Ezra, and he concluded this. If there is no iniquity, if there's none observed, then God maintains his kindness to Israel, because it says the Lord his God is with them. And so, therefore, no weapon formed against him shall prosper, even if it's a soothsayer from Mesopotamia who has in the past proven able to curse people and bring about their destruction. No weapon formed against him will prosper. However, if Israel sins, God withdraws his kindness and he allows punishment. So in that statement right there, we can see that Balaam learned the best way to harm Israel is not to curse them, but to entice them to sin. If the adversary cannot curse what God has blessed, then he can seduce them to sin, and they'll do to themselves what their enemies don't have the power to do. This is exactly what we were speaking of just a few moments ago. The serpent was in the midst of the garden, but he couldn't curse the man and the woman. However, he seduced them into sin. Sanballat, when Nehemiah was rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, he made a plea to Nehemiah, let us help you, and we'll help you rebuild the walls, but Nehemiah fortunately says, no, we're fine. Well, the reason is Sanballat wanted to get into the midst of them to kill them. The whole idea is the adversary wants to get into their midst. And typically the way he does that is with something that looks good, that appears to be helpful, it appears to be beautiful, what have you. But it's intended to seduce God's people into sin, to bring about the destruction from within. That's the point. Now, verse 23, it mentions that unlike Moab and unlike Balak, the king of Moab, there's no need for divination in Israel because God Almighty is with them. Another way to look at this is that no enchantment prevails against Israel. In other words, the black arts have no power over God's people. Again, I don't believe that believers in the Messiah should fear a witch's curse or a voodoo doctor's curse or anything like that. Because once again, these enchantments don't prevail against Israel. The only way that something like that is going to make inroads is when Israel, when we are walking in disobedience. You'll remember that God delivered Israel from Egypt by his might and not by magicians' tricks. In fact, when the Egyptian magicians brought their rod and it turned into a serpent, the rod of Aaron devoured the rod of the Egyptian magicians. So Balak is trying to curse with magic a nation blessed because it has repudiated magic. It has walked away from those kinds of things. It is serving the Most High God, who doesn't work by magic. He works by his mighty power, his universal and complete power. In verse 23, now it is said of Jacob and Israel, what has God wrought? One way to look at this is, in due time, it will be told to Jacob and Israel what God does. In other words, he lets his people know what's about to happen when it's time. There's no need for divination or enchantments, in other words. He will let you know. He will let you know what he is doing or is about to do. In the tabernacle, the priests or the high priest inquired the Lord by the Urim and Thummim, the Urim and the Thummim, in order to hear from God. They didn't require enchantments because we understand in Amos chapter 3, verse 7, surely the Lord God does nothing unless he reveals his secret to his servants, the prophets. So all of that is to say that there is no need for enchantments and divination and all these different kinds of things in Israel. The Creator lets his people know what he's doing, when he's going to do it, when it's time for them to know. So at this point, in verse 25, Balak is very frustrated and he says to Balaam, look, don't curse them, don't bless them, just keep quiet, don't say anything else. And yet, he still takes him to another point. And this place is called Peor. He wants Balaam to look at them just one more time. Perhaps he's still holding out that something Balaam will see, take note of, will change God's mind. Because we understand from Jewish commentary that Balak is a sorcerer himself. And so he takes Balaam to a place that eventually is going to prove to be a detriment to Israel. Because Peor is a place where an idol was worshipped. And so here we see the text telling us that Balaam again has altars built. And so we come into chapter 24 and we're going to read about Balaam's final prophecy. In verse 1 it says, it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, so he went not as at the other times. He saw that it's pointless to try to curse them. So he didn't do things the same way. And so he didn't meet with any enchantments, but he just set his face toward the wilderness, it says. Because he apparently realized that his enchantments in order to curse were of no use. He was just wasting his time. So he resolves to say whatever it is that God is going to give him to say. In verse 2, he saw Israel dwelling tribe by tribe, and that's when the Spirit of God came upon him. At this point, he's not addressing Balak, but he is speaking audibly, presumably, and he's speaking to the future. He's being prophetic. And so in verse 3, his prophecy begins with talking about himself, Balaam, the man whose eye is opened, which is a dramatic contrast to when he was on this journey making his way to Balak and does not see the angel of the Lord standing in the way. But at this point, his eye is opened. And it says that he hears the words of God and he sees the vision of the Almighty. And so eventually and ultimately, even heathens, even sorcerers, soothsayers, and magicians are destined to confess God's truth and his word. Again, Nebuchadnezzar was that head of gold, according to Daniel in chapter 2. But in Daniel 3, the head of gold, Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar proclaims the Creator as the Most High God. Every knee shall bow, and every tongue will confess. In verse 5, he says, how goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. In Hebrew, it's Matovu, Ohalecha Yaakov, Mishkanotecha Yisrael. And as we said at the very beginning of this commentary, this is something that's repeated in synagogue services every Shabbat. So how interesting that something that is so common in the synagogue as it relates to Israel was first uttered by someone who was seeking to curse Israel. Now the rabbis liken the tents of Jacob to the Torah and the tabernacles of Israel to the synagogues. Perhaps. Yet he saw them dwelling tribe by tribe. And so to me, when he says, how goodly are your tents, your dwelling places, O Israel, I believe that he saw them dwelling tribe by tribe in a united Israel. That is, a united kingdom, tribe by tribe, under the kingship of the Messiah. And so, as we continue to read, these subsequent verses, as far as I'm concerned anyway, support this idea. In verse 7, for instance, it says, his seed shall be in many waters. His king shall be higher than Agag, who was the royal line of Amalek, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Many waters, that can speak of nations and multitudes. His seed, Well, what is his seed? Speaking of the Creator. Well, the Creator's seed is his word, which is personified as the Messiah, according to Galatians 3. But his seed is also the sons of the kingdom, according to Matthew chapter 13. And so Israel's seed, in some ways, is synonymous with the Creator's seed, because we're talking about his people, either way you look at it. So his people, Israel, is going to be found in all nations and in all multitudes. It's going to spread out. So again, his seed alludes to his word, his Messiah, and his people Israel. Mark 4, the seed is the word. Galatians 3, the Messiah is the seed. Again, Matthew 13, the sons of the kingdom, that's us. So his people are going to spread out through the earth, through all nations and through the multitudes. His kingdom will be exalted speaks of the kingdom of Israel under the Messiah, because in Daniel chapter 7, verse 14, Daniel says, "And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed." So he's talking about in the future, Israel under the kingship of the Messiah, dwelling tribe by tribe. In verse 9, Bilaam says, "Blessed be everyone that blesses you, and cursed be everyone that curses you." So oddly, he has to say, even though I came to curse you, if I did curse you, I'd be cursed. And so I'm going to bless you, and everyone who blesses you will be blessed. Instead of being cursed from without, instead of being susceptible to someone's curses through an external force, Israel is going to be a source of blessing for others. Blessing is going to emanate from Israel out to the other nations, which this just reiterates what God told Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3. "I'll curse those that curse you. I'll bless those that bless you." And again, it's ironic, isn't it, that this is spoken by the one who had intended to curse them, and he's saying this in front of someone who intends to curse them. And so at that point in verse 10, Balak was enraged. And he says, instead of cursing them, you've blessed them three times. And just as a footnote, he blesses them three times. And does that have anything to do with the fact that he struck his donkey three times on the journey to Moab? Now in verse 11, Balak says, "I intended to promote you and to give you honor, but the Lord has kept you from receiving that honor." Now that statement really resonates with me, because the world is telling Balaam, if I can put it that way, "I was going to give you this and I was going to give you that, but the Lord has kept you from receiving that honor. Because you're choosing to do what the Lord says, you can't have all these things." Remember, when the adversary appears to the Messiah, "I'll give you all these kingdoms and all these dominions. All you got to do is bow down to me." But obviously and thankfully, Yeshua did not do that. In other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you are going to walk according to the Creator's instructions, then all the things that the world would give you, the Lord will keep you from receiving that honor. You know, Balak is trying to shame Balaam as a failure. Even though Balaam reminds him, "Look, I told you from the very beginning I would speak only what God gave me to speak." And so Balaam is saying, "God is keeping you from receiving all this honor that I bestow upon you." But what kind of honor is it? It's the honor of wicked men. And what kind of honor is there among thieves? It's the honor of wicked men that the Lord is keeping him from. God gave Balaam an opportunity to say yes or to say no to man's honor code. So likewise, you and I are going to be given, or have been given, are being given, the same opportunity. That is, to receive the honor of men or be respected by the Creator. We shouldn't seek the honor of men. That is the point. Because the honor of men always comes with a price tag that is going to put us in opposition to the Creator. Yeshua addressed this issue for us in John chapter 5. He says, verse 41, "I do not receive honor from men. How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes from God only? Now, in Numbers 24, verse 14, Balaam is, before he goes home, going to announce to Balak or advise to Balak what Israel is going to do to his people Moab. But when it says that he is going to advise him, some commentators take that as a hint that this is when he told Balak the only way that he could ever hope to overcome Israel. In other words, Balaam set out a snare that would get God to do to Israel what Balak and Balaam could not. Once again, he can't curse them, but he can seduce them into sin. And that plan is going to come to fruition in the very next chapter. And later in the book of Numbers, in chapter 31, verse 16, Moses makes it clear that it indeed was Balaam's plan that caused Israel to sin. Yet, nevertheless, in this prophecy, he lays out what will become of Israel in the future, ultimately speaking of the Messianic era. But he also, in talking about what becomes of Israel, talks of what becomes of Moab and all of Israel's enemies. In chapter 24, beginning at verse 17, he says, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall crush the forehead of Moab, and break down all the sons of Seth. And Edom shall be a possession. Seir also shall be a possession for his enemies. And Israel shall do valiantly. Out of Jacob shall come he that shall have dominion, and shall destroy him that remains of the city. So there's several things that we want to talk about in this particular prophecy. First of all, the star. Rabbinical writings suggest that the star is David, who is the first, of course, to bring Moab into subjection. And the scepter in this prophecy refers to the kingdom of Israel. But the star is understood ultimately to refer to the son of David, who is the Messiah. In fact, commentaries suggest that this star is actually a meteor or a shooting star because, and this is a direct quote from a commentary, he will have to flash across heaven, visible to the whole world, to gather in Israel from their dispersion. That's from a Jewish point of view. In other words, this star prophecy likens the coming of the Messiah to a flash across the heavens as a meteor or a shooting star, which is really fascinating when you consider what Yeshua has to say in Matthew 24, beginning in verse 27. For as the lightning comes out of the east and shines into the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. In verse 30 it says, And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with the great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. In other words, when he is gathering in all of Israel from their dispersion, he will be like a flash across the heavens that is visible to the whole world, just as this Jewish commentary puts it. Again, this was based on the star prophecy of Numbers 24. In Revelation chapter 1, verse 7, it says this of the Messiah, Behold, he comes with the clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also which pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth shall wail because of him. Now, just a footnote to that, in both these passages that we just read, it talks about all of the tribes. Some people believe that when it says all the tribes of the earth in Matthew chapter 24, that that's all the tribes of the land. Remember, Balaam sees them dwelling tribe by tribe. And then again in Revelation 1, which is really, in Hebrew, hitgalut, it's speaking of the dispersion and the gathering in of the dispersed of Israel. It says that all the tribes of the earth, or all the tribes of the land. So all these things are connecting to the idea that when he sees Israel dwelling tribe by tribe, I believe that that is in the era of the Messianic kingdom, under the kingship of the Messiah, who is the star. Now, concerning Israel's enemies, there's a lot of prophecies that discuss the fate of Moab and Edom and all these other different nations. Obadiah, for instance, in its entirety, describes Edom's destruction. But all of these nations being put down is really describing the redemption. Judaism refers to the current exile as the Edomite exile, meaning that Israel is right now under the oppression of Edom, because in Genesis 25, the prophecy concerning the two sons of Rivka and Isaac, that prophecy says more or less that one is going to ascend while the other is descending. They're not going to be able to coexist. They're not going to share power. One will be powerful, the other will be oppressed. If the other arises, then the other one who had been in ascendancy will then descend. So then, currently, the way Judaism sees it, and I don't disagree either, this is the Edomite exile, because right now Israel is not on top of the mountain, so to speak. Edom is, Esau is. But at the end of days, the Messiah, who is the king of Israel, is going to once and for all vanquish Edom or Seir, and Israel is going to rule over Esau, because in Genesis 25, the prophecy also says that the older shall serve the younger. In other words, in the end, ultimately, the older one, Esau, Edom, is going to be submissive to the younger. That is Jacob, or if you will, Israel. And at this time, this star is going to break down all the sons of Seth. If you think about it, Seth is really the ancestor of all people who existed after the flood, because Noah was a descendant of Seth. And so it's from the line of Seth that we get Noah, and then Noah has Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So all the sons of Seth is speaking of all the nations of the earth. Thus, the star is going to rule over all the nations of the earth. Revelation 11:15. The kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Messiah, and he shall reign forever and ever. Now, I find very interesting this comment that it says that the star will destroy him who remains in the city. To me, that's interesting because the first city builders were Cain and Nimrod, both rebels. And while we certainly don't have time to get into it here, we have other teachings that discuss the city builders, Cain and Nimrod, and what these cities first represented. Another interesting aspect of this is Judas Iscariot, the one that the Messiah refers to as a devil among the 12. He's the devil. He's called Judas Iscariot, but that is taken from Hebrew, Yehuda Iscariot. Yehuda, Judas, Iscariot. In other words, his last name was not Iscariot. That's a title, more or less. Iscariot. Literally, that means man of the cities. So Cain built a city, Nimrod built a city, Judas was a man of the cities. Remember, he was pretending that he wanted to support the poor, but all the while he was really wanting to line his own pockets. So outwardly he wants everybody to think, I'm here to help the poor, but he was really to help himself. Interesting that the Greek word for city is polis, and from that we get the words like politan and metropolitan, we get the word police, and we get the word politics, politician. And in my book, generally speaking, politicians are those who establish laws in defiance of the Creator's law. So interesting that he says, I will destroy him who remains in the city, because the city has a reputation of being aligned with rebels, with devils, with thieves, with murderers, with those who establish laws in defiance of the Creator's law. Now in verse 20, it says that Amalek is first among the nations, but its end will be eternal destruction. Amalek is first in that he is the primary nation among Esau's descendants. He's the first to attack Israel as they exited Egypt. So Amalek is first because Amalek is the embodiment of this intense hatred for Israel, this baseless hatred. So the Messiah is ultimately going to destroy Amalek. In verses 21 and 22, it says that he looked upon the Kenite, and he goes on to say that Cain shall be wasted. Now, this I find very, very interesting. The Kenite in Hebrew is Hakeni, and it's spelled He, Kuf, Yud, Nun, Yud. Cain here is spelled Kuf, Yud, Nun, which is identical to the spelling of Cain of Genesis 4. Now, obviously, because the flood has taken place, these are not the descendants of Cain, at least not in a physical sense. But are they not, perhaps, related in nature, in characteristic, in their behavior? So perhaps that is what links them to Cain of Genesis 4. Perhaps that's why they carry such a name. Now, there are exceptions to this, of course, because in Judges chapter 1, verse 16, we're told that Jethro belonged to this family because it's part of the Midianites. In verse 23, who will survive when he imposes these? And first reading this, actually, it was a little difficult to understand, but it had just mentioned Syria. And so it seems to be saying that there's going to come a time when Assyria is going to be given temporary dominion. How is the Messiah going to destroy all these other nations? There seems to be a hint here, not that he's going out personally and destroying them, but that he is using someone else to do his bidding. Much like the fact that the Creator says, I'm going to strike down the firstborn of Egypt from Pharaoh's house down to the prison cell, man and beast. But when we read the text very carefully, it would seem that while the Lord was passing over the houses that had the blood upon the door, that is, in an act of protecting them, the destroyer was going through the land to actually take the lives of all the firstborn of Egypt. In other words, the Lord was responsible. He's the one who declared it. But he brings about his will through the destroyer. So then, there might be a hint here that the way the Messiah, the star, if you will, is going to put down all of these nations, is, or at least many of them, is through Assyria. Assyria will be given temporary dominion, and all the things that transpire under the Assyrian is going to be the travail that ultimately ushers in the Messianic Age. And at that time, it will be difficult for people to survive the Syrian, though Israel will eventually prevail. Now, here's what Isaiah has to say in chapter 10, beginning at verse 5. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger. See there, there's a very, very important statement. The rod of my anger. My anger is going to bring retribution upon the nations, but I'm going to use Assyria. And the staff in their hand is my fury. I will send him against an ungodly nation and against the people of my wrath. I will command him to take the plunder and to strip off the spoil and to trample them like the mud of the streets. And we're going to go down to verse 24 of Isaiah 10 now. Therefore, so says the Lord of hosts, O my people who dwell in Zion, do not fear Assyria. He shall strike you with a rod and shall lift up his staff against you in the way of Egypt. But yet a little while, and the fury shall cease, and my anger shall be in their ruin. And the Lord of hosts shall stir up a whip on him, according to the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. And as his rod was on the sea, so shall he lift it up in the way of Egypt. And it shall be in that day, his burden shall be taken away from off your shoulder, and his yoke from off your neck. And the yoke shall be destroyed because of the anointing. In other words, Syria is going to arise, it's going to be given temporary dominion, but eventually Israel is going to triumph, not because of their merit, but because of the Messiah, because of God's faithfulness, because of God's mercy. Now in verse 24, we see that big ships from Kittim will afflict Syria, but it too, that is Kittim, will be destroyed. Rabbinical sources make this to be the Roman Empire because they succeeded the Grecians and they conquered the lands of Assyria, which included Israel, by the way, and they conquered the lands across the Euphrates. Now, in Daniel's prophecy in chapter 7, he speaks of four beasts, and the fourth beast is the one who surpasses all the previous three in strength and just fierceness. And so that is believed to be the Roman Empire. Now, Kittim is literally descended from Yavan or Javan, which is Greece. And by the way, that's the third beast in Daniel chapter 7. But the Kittim developed into a powerful nation who eventually became the Roman Empire. Now, in addition to the conquest of Assyria, this verse alludes to the other bank. Now, that word is Ever. Ever, or we might say Eber. It comes from the root word avar, which means to cross over. And from that word, of course, we get the word Ivri or Hebrew. This may be a hint that the current exile, which is called the Edomite exile, is also referred to as the Roman exile. The Romans surpassed the Grecians. They conquered the Syrian lands, including the land of Israel, and the Roman Empire are the ones who destroyed Jerusalem in 70, and they dispersed the Jews. And since that time, up until 1948, the Jews did not live in Jerusalem, there was no homeland, etc., etc. And even though Jews have come back to Israel and others are coming back into the land, nevertheless, the prophets make it very clear that not all things have come to fruition. So then, this current exile, the Edomite exile, also known as the Roman exile, because Judaism sees the Roman Empire as being Edom, this exile will be ended by the Messiah and the Messiah alone. Now, even though it's called the Roman exile, the Edomite exile, there have been other empires that have also afflicted Israel in this time frame. One example, of course, is Islam. But nevertheless, this is referred to as a Roman exile or an Edomite exile because they're the ones that initiated it, and still it has not come to an end, not completely, because the Messiah has not come to put an end to it. Now, as we go through this, to me, it's amazing to consider the details of these prophecies that are given through vision or dreams to people like Balaam, who is a heathen. He's a sorcerer. But think about it. Some of the most dramatic prophetic dreams, visions, what have you, were given not to God's people, but to pagans, to heathens. Nebuchadnezzar, Pharaoh, he gave them these dreams. He gave them these visions. He allowed them to make these prophecies. It's fascinating. In many cases, though, he did not give them the understanding of what these things meant. So all of that is to say, you can't make a determination about someone's spiritual status based solely on their ability to prophesy. In other words, Balaam is prophesying in great detail about the Messiah, the kingdom of Israel, etc., the nations that are going to be destroyed, the nations that are going to be used. And just the average person standing around listening to someone prophesy like this might be tempted to think, well, they're a man of God. But you can't make a determination about someone based on an ability to prophesy. Because Saul prophesied after an evil spirit came upon him. In 1 Samuel 18, verse 10, "And it came to pass on the morrow that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of the house. And David played with his hand, as he did day by day, and Saul had his spear in his hand." After the evil spirit came upon Saul, he prophesied. But at the same time, he was wanting to run David through with a javelin. So then, you can't base someone's spiritual walk or status on their ability to prophesy. "You shall know them by their fruits." And verse 25, Balak and Balaam parted ways, but obviously not before Balaam had laid out a plan for Balak. Because later on, we're going to see that Balaam was killed among the Midianites shortly after. So he must have lingered. He must have stuck around. Even though he told Balak, "I'm going home," he must have kind of hung around to see how the plan was going to unfold. And I would presume if it was successful, so that he could get his money, his reward, and his honor. And so now we come into chapter 25. And beginning at verse 1, we read, "And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. For they called the people unto the sacrifices of their gods, and the people did eat, and bowed down to their gods. And Israel joined himself to Baal Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. And so this was the plan developed by Balaam and given to Balak. And as I said earlier, this is in concert with the methodology of the adversary. Because again, the adversary can't curse Israel, but he does have the ability to seduce Israel into cursing themselves. And his methods are always going to include, or they always seem to include, something that is appealing to the eye. In the very beginning, it was the tree of good and evil. And chances are, he didn't expose the evil side. He wanted the woman to see the good side. In Genesis 6, you have the sons of God, and they see the beautiful daughters of men, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose, which leads to the flood. So we have, in this case, many Israelites have accepted the invitation of beautiful women, both from Moab and from Midian. As a matter of fact, we understand that the leaders of Moab and Midian were so intent on destroying Israel and so zealous for this plan to work that these leaders sent their own daughters to seduce the men of Israel. And so we see that Israel joined them in this sacrificial rite at Baal Peor. Notice that this begins with a meal. These sacrificial rites. The people did eat, it says. And so the first thing they use to lure them is food. What did the adversary use? Was food. But after the food, they go into all of these sacrifices to their gods and bowing down to their gods. And we understand that these rites and this all of this behavior would have included all of this licentious behavior, and all that followed a meal. In other words, the adversary still uses the same game plan, it seems. And it says that they joined themselves, literally yoked themselves to this idol. And the word there suggests imagery like a woman joins herself to her husband. In fact, the word Baal or Baal is husband. Peor is the mountain. But Baal Peor is to say this idol, this god, this husband of the mountain. And so they yoked themselves to this idol as a bride to a husband. And this is what provokes the Lord to jealousy, because he is supposed to be the husband. He's a jealous god. Now, it would seem that the women of Midian were a lot more persuasive than the Moabite women. Tradition, and I underscore that word, but tradition says that the Midianites even tried to seduce the leaders, including Moses. But when that failed, they turned to those of lesser rank, even though they were still princes and notable people, but they were of lesser rank, and that would be include people like Zimri. Now later, down the road, God commands Israel to exact vengeance upon Midian in Numbers 31. So all of that is to say, the Midianite women seem to have gone to greater lengths to try to seduce the men of Israel. Now, this place, Peor, you will remember that this was the final place that Balaam had stood as he looked upon Israel. Maybe, because Baal was worshipped there, maybe that's what gave him inspiration for his plan. Nevertheless, the people responded. They bowed down to this false god, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and that resulted in a plague that killed many people. Now, when the Torah refers to God's anger as wrath, it is always provoked by immorality. In other words, you don't see his wrath at work unless his people have committed an immorality. And that immoral behavior is accentuated by the fact that he is among them. Not only that, but consider that he has just prevented Balaam from cursing them, though he wanted desperately to do so. So all of those things, all those factors, just compound the egregious error that Israel made. Now, verse 4, it says that Moses enlisted the aid of the chief men or judges who were to slay those who were guilty of this sin. These judges were the same men who were selected back in Exodus 28 to settle disputes. But now they're going to settle this dispute. And they're going to go through and they're going to, according to verse 5, slay everyone who joined themselves to the Baal Peor, so that the Lord's anger might be turned away. Now I want to read verse 6 of Numbers 25. It says, "And behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, while they were weeping at the door of the tent of meeting." Now later on, we are told in the Torah portion called Pinchas, which is the ensuing Torah portion, that this man of the children of Israel, was a prince of Simeon by the name of Zimri. And so he brings this strange woman into the camp, but not just into the camp, to the door of the tent of meeting, while Moses and all the people are weeping over this behavior. He is so brazen that he brings this woman to the very door and apparently begins to have relations with her right there in sight of everybody. So beyond just having relations with the woman, he apparently taunts Moses, he taunts the people of Israel right in the sight of the Mishkan. He is literally putting it in their face. And all the while, they're weeping over what the people have done. Now, one other thing popped into my mind is that he brings this Midianite woman in the sight of Moses. And I wonder, was the fact that Moses was actually married to a Midianite woman, I wonder if that had anything to do with his brazenness. I don't know. It's just a thought. But anyway, here's what we see. At that point in time, in verses 7 and 8, the son of Aaron, whose name is Pinchas, took a spear and he killed both of them, apparently while they're in the act of cohabitation. But his quick action is what stopped the plague. And by the time it had stopped, according to verse 9, a total of 24,000 people were killed. Later on, in a census that comes out after the plague, the tribe of Simeon has the greatest decrease in population. And Simeon's tribe was camped to the south and would have been one of the closest tribes to the Moabites. And just a footnote to this, in one of the previous Torah portions, Korah, we see Dathan and Abiram, who are of the tribe of Reuben, who would have also been camping to the south. And Korah, who was a Levite, but of the Kohathites, who camped south of the tent of meeting, they're the ones that led the rebellion against Moses. And so this man of Simeon, Zimri, was from that same part of the camp where all this rebellion in previous Torah portions had come from. Now, in the next Torah portion, we're going to see what becomes of Pinchas as a result of his quick action. But we'll save that for the next Torah portion. So we've come to the end of this one. I want to thank you for joining me. I hope you're gleaning something from our commentaries here. This is Bill Cloud. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a Bill Cloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.